but additional scientific knowledge we cannot give to Earth except as we are now doing in a manner perfectly in accord and harmony with cosmic law. Already man's material knowledge has far outstripped the growth of brotherly love and spiritual understanding in his heart. Therein lies the present danger. To add to the destructive phase of man's scientific knowledge is not permitted. We are working now to turn that knowledge to constructive purposes upon Earth. Also, we hope to give men a deeper knowledge and understanding of their own true nature and a greater awareness of the evolutionary crisis facing them. At present, we are working along all constructive lines of human endeavor and especially in the fields of medicine and healing. Surely you cannot fail to see the tremendous advances which have been made in this direction within the last few years. Even greater discoveries are at hand, including success in the fight against cancer. Thus shall we continue to work with and through men. I listened to the compassionate voice, trying to imprint every word on my consciousness. But I have forgotten much, and these words are only a poor attempt to recall all that I heard. The voice continued speaking, "We know your mind is filled with questions. One question in particular troubles you, and it concerns the entity the world knows as Jesus Christ. May we set your mind at rest? In allegorical language, Christ is indeed the Son of God. The star that burned over Bethlehem is a cosmic fact. It announced the birth on your planet of an entity, not of Earth's evolution. He is Lord of the Flame, an infinite entity of the sun. Out of compassion for mankind's suffering, he became flesh and blood and entered the hell of ignorance, woe and evil. As the sun spirit who sacrificed himself for the children of woe, he has become a part of the oversoul of mankind and the world spirit. In this he differs from all other world teachers. Each person upon it has a spiritual, or unknown, self which transcends the material world and consciousness and dwells eternally out of the time dimension in spiritual perfection within the unity of the oversoul. In the illusion of time is written man's choice through free will, whereby he set in motion the cause of error which inevitably resulted in effect, in which mankind entered mortal consciousness or the living death of his present existence. Thus was he separated from his eternal and perfect self. His one purpose upon earth now is to attain reunion with his immortal consciousness. When this is accomplished, he is resurrected from the kingdom of death and becomes his real immortal self, made in the image and likeness of God. Your teacher has told you, God is love, and in these simple words may be found the secrets of all the mysteries of earth and the worlds beyond. Tears coursed down my cheeks. Under the spiritual scrutiny of that great, compassionate consciousness, I felt like a crawling worm, unclean, filled with error and sin. Yes, I say sin, but not in the ordinary sense men use that word. Rather, sin as sin really is. And basically, sin is hypocrisy, falsity, the living lie. It is looking at your fellow man with a friendly smile upon your face with treacherous, malicious, or mocking thoughts in your heart. Sin is any and all deviations from absolute truth, perfect love, absolute honesty and righteous motives. Thus actual sin has little to do with earthly standards of sin. As these realizations filled my consciousness, I wanted to fling myself down upon the floor and hide my head in shame for humanity. And of all men, I at that moment felt the lowliest, the least worthy to be where I was. I wondered how those great beings could love such a one as I or any of mankind. We with our bloody wars, our intense hatreds, our cheap, shoddy intolerances, our greed and avarice and our cruel inhumanity to our fellow men. I hid my head in my hands and wept bitter tears for a creature so full of error and hypocrisy and yet so puffed up with egotistical pride over our little material knowledge. At that moment, as in a dream, I heard the strains of the Lord's Prayer, played as though by thousands of violins. As I crouched in the chair, fresh tears poured from my eyes. My heart was filled with humility, contrition and with gratitude, gratitude that these great ones had even considered our miserable selfish existence. Above the exquisite strains of melody, the voice said, "Beloved friend of earth, we baptize you now in the true light of the world's eternal." A blinding white beam flashed from the dome of the craft. Momentarily I seemed partially to lose consciousness. Everything expanded into a great shimmering white light. I seemed to be projected beyond time and space and was conscious only of light, light, light. Orfeo, Earth, the past were as nothing, a dark dream of a moment. And that dream unfolded before my eyes in swift panorama. Every event of my life upon Earth was crystal clear to me, and then memory of all of my previous lives upon Earth returned. In that sublime moment, I knew the mystery of life. Also, I realized with a terrible certainty that we are all, each one of us, trapped in eternity and allotted only one brief awareness at a time. I am dying, I thought. I have been through this death before in other earthly lives. This is death. Only now I am in eternity, without beginning and without end. Then slowly everything resolved into radiant light, peace and indescribable beauty. Free of all falsity of mortality, I drifted in a timeless sea of bliss. At last, as from a vivid dream, I regained consciousness. Dazedly, I looked about the interior of the craft. Everything was the same, but it seemed 10,000 years had passed in what must have been only a few moments. I was half conscious of a burning sensation on my left side just below the heart, but I thought nothing of it then. Ethereal drifts of music were in the air. Far away, I could feel, more than hear, a pulsing vibration beneath the floor of the craft. Also, I was again aware of the gentle push of my body against the cushioned chair. I realized I was being taken back to Earth. In an incredibly short time the wall opened and I saw the familiar surroundings. Yes, I knew I was home again. But I also realized a little sadly that Earth could never again really be my home. In the spiritual evolution of mankind, I had been expendable in this life. Thus had I passed through death and attained infinite life. As I got up from the comfortable chair, I reached down and picked up the strange, shining bit of metal and carried it in my hand as I left the craft. In a kind of daze I walked away from the ship, then curiously turned to look at it from the outside once more. But it was gone. I looked up and there it was high in the sky, faintly visible as a fuzzy luminous bubble. Then suddenly it was not there at all, but high in the northeastern sky I saw a red, glowing disk which changed to green and vanished. I glanced down at the round bit of strange metal in my hand. I was glowing and livid again and appeared almost to be alive as it quivered in contact with my flesh. Also, it was rapidly diminishing in size. By the time I had reached home it had dissipated into nothingness. As I was undressing to go to bed, I remembered again the burning sensation I had felt on my left side while I was undergoing the profound initiation in the saucer. I glanced down and saw what appeared to be a circular burn about the size of a quarter on my left side directly below my heart. The outer rim of the circle was red, inflamed and slightly raised, as also was a small dot in the center of the circle, the symbol of the hydrogen atom. I realized they had impressed that mark upon my body to convince me beyond all doubt of the reality of my experiences in the cold light of the coming days. Chapter 3: My meeting with Neptune. Following the emotional shock of that profound and bewildering trip in the saucer, I went about in a veritable daze for weeks. I continued on the job at Lockheed and resumed the routine of my daily affairs, but I was like an automaton, a dweller in two worlds and at home in neither. It is almost impossible to explain my state of mind, but the great spiritual illumination I had received in the saucer left me something of a stranger to my own planet, Earth. I longed to tell the world, to blazon out the truths of my discoveries, yet I knew that for the greater part I must forever remain silent. Among other glimpses of reality, I attained the realization that time is non-existent. What we call time exists only in the physical world and is an illusion of the senses. Also, I know now that our concept of space is entirely erroneous. But who could I convince of these and other truths, who would believe me? But because they had requested that I tell earthlings of my experiences, I told many persons about my trip in the flying saucer. Nearly everyone laughed and ridiculed me. I was the butt of numerous jokes. Someone was always wisecracking, "Are your saucer pals going to show up tonight, Orfeo?" Or, "Tell one of the saucers to land over at the drive-in theater, Angie, and then we'll all believe it." Such remarks invariably brought forth gales of laughter at my expense. But I no longer cared, I knew, and that was enough. As my story got around, several newspapers printed derisive accounts of the saucer man. It cut deeply to see the embarrassment and humiliation it all caused my two sons. They knew people were saying their father was a screwball. They didn't want to go to school because their companions laughed at them. I knew it all hurt Mabel too. Mabel pleaded with me to forget my experiences. I tried to explain to her why I had to tell about them, and we had some bitter misunderstandings on the subject. I wanted so much to do something constructive, but I didn't know how to go about it. I began calling various military and defense offices. The personnel of several of the smaller ones laughed openly and passed me off, I know, as a crackpot. But it was with tremendous relief I found the really important offices referred me to men who were genuinely interested. They questioned and cross-questioned me concerning the information I gave them. A little later I began giving weekly talks to small groups of interested people about space visitors. At first these meetings were held in private homes and then as the attendance increased we met in the Los Feliz clubhouse. In what little spare time I had I began writing down my experiences and planned to publish them in a small news sheet, for I believed I could reach more people that way. But as the days and weeks passed following my fantastic trip in the saucer and nothing more happened, I began to feel a little uncertain. The constant ridicule and laughter created even more doubts. My insistence upon the absolute truth of my experiences finally appeared to be definitely alienating my friends and even my family. My story was unbelieved upon Earth and the mysterious visitors were doing nothing to aid me. I actually began to doubt my own sanity, to wonder if the bizarre experiences had been an illusion or hallucination of some sort. And yet an inner tribunal of truth assured me that such was not the case, for with them I had seen and known reality, and I could never forget that. On the night of August 2nd I and Mabel were helping out at the Los Feliz Drive-In Theater snack bar. About 11 o'clock I went outside for a breath of fresh air. Over the hills to the west I noticed a fuzzy green light apparently hanging suspended in the sky. I watched it for several moments, then went inside and called Mabel and seven or eight others to come out and see it. All of them saw the mysterious light hanging motionless in the sky over the hill. Unable to explain it, some of them declared it must be a helicopter hovering in the air. Others thought it might be a high street lamp of some sort. But when after 3 or 4 minutes the street lamp climbed slowly and silently into the heavens and suddenly vanished, no one had much to say. But for some perverse reason none of them wanted to admit that it was actually a flying saucer. As they trooped back into the cafe laughing about Orfeo and his flying saucers, a depressing wave of discouragement passed over me. It was useless, absolutely useless, to talk to anyone about the saucers or my experiences. Feeling greatly disheartened and very much alone, I decided to leave and walk home. As I cut across the vacant lots, the Hyperion Avenue freeway bridge loomed huge and dark ahead of me. The sky was overcast and the dense, oblique shadows from the vast concrete structure were heavier and more eerie than usual. Yet in the shadows of the dark archways of the bridge I had come to feel a kind of warmth and welcome, a spiritual communion with a vastly greater and more kindly world. For it was in the shadows of the huge bridge that I had come upon the saucer which had carried me out of this world. I was thinking of these things when I suddenly became aware of someone approaching from out of the darkness. I was startled, for I'd never before met anyone taking the shortcut beneath the bridge so late at night. I was about to call out a word of greeting when it dawned upon me that the stranger was coming from the dead end of the bridge. My first thought was that someone was lying in wait for me, possibly to rob me. But before I could become alarmed, I heard the stranger call, "Greetings, Orfeo." My heart almost stopped beating, for immediately I recognized the vibrant, beautiful voice of a being who had spoken to me in the saucer. I stopped in my tracks, utterly speechless, and stared at the approaching figure. But then a wave of joy and gratitude flooded over me, and I finally replied falteringly, "Greetings to you." He laughed pleasantly. "I know that in your mind you have given me a name, I who have remained nameless to you, he said gently. You may call me by that name, Orfeo. It is as good as any other and has more inner significance to you than any name I might give you. Neptune. I spoke the name slowly and reverently. For it was indeed the name I had given to this great and mysterious being. Then I added, at last you have come to give me strength and faith. He was near enough then for me to see that he was several inches taller than I and similar in outline to a well-built man, but the shadows were so heavy that I couldn't make out the details of his figure. But just to be in his presence once more was to sense again a tremendous uplifting wave of strength, harmony, joy and serenity. Old Borbank picture, come, Orfeo, he said gently, continuing on past me. We have many things to discuss tonight. I followed him as he strode ahead of me through the dense shadows. I could hear his solid footsteps upon the graveled path, which convinced me beyond the shadow of a doubt that he was no phantom or illusion. He led me to a better lighted area near the bend of Glendale Boulevard, below where it goes up and over the bridge. I was actually trembling in anticipation of my first actual look at the mysterious visitor from another world. When he turned, I saw his face, the same wonderful, expressive countenance I had seen on the luminous screen. I again noticed especially his extremely large, dark and expressive eyes and nobility and beauty of his features, which actually seemed to radiate warmth and kindliness. Then I noticed that he was wearing a kind of uniform, bluish in color, perfectly tailored and tightly fitted to the outlines of his body. But it was apparently without seams, buttons, pockets, trimmings or design of any sort. In fact, it fitted so perfectly that it was almost like a part of his body. But as I studied him, I became aware of an astonishing phenomenon. I could see his uniform and figure clearly, but it wavered occasionally, as though I were viewing it through rippling water. And the color did not remain solid and uniform, but varied and changed in spots, which reminded me of an imperfectly tuned television set. Only his face and hands remained immobile and stable, as though not partially obscured by a film of rippling water. Headlights from approaching automobiles fell upon us from time to time, and I remember wondering what manner of being my companion appeared to be to those in the passing cars. Did they see him at all? If so, did he appear as solid and substantial as myself? He moved forward again, motioning for me to follow him. Without speaking, he led me down the sharp concrete declivity into the bed of the dry Los Angeles River, picked below. There he sat down upon a large stone and motioned for me to do likewise. For a time he was silent, and I was acutely conscious of a tremendous vibrational field about him, a tangible emanation of serenity, brotherly love, and ineffable joy. At last he said, "You sense and understand intuitively many things I cannot say directly to you, Orfeo. You have just fully realized that we are not like Earthmen in that we function in dimensions unknown to your world. Earth is a three-dimensional world, and because of this it is preponderantly false. I may tell you that to the entities of certain other worlds Earth is regarded as the accursed planet, the home of the reprobate, fallen ones. Others call your Earth the home of sorrows. For Earth's evolution is evolution through pain, sorrow, sin, suffering and the illusion of physical death. Believe me, all evolutions are not similar to Earth's, despite the present beliefs of your scientists." As I heard these strange words, my heart and mind cried out, "But why must it be so? Why should Earth's people know pain, suffering and death?" He looked up into the heavens, and in the soft light I saw deep compassion in his face as he said slowly, "The answer to that question is one of the mysteries of the illusion of time. But I can tell you this, such conditions did not always prevail among the entities who now inhabit Earth. Once there was another planet in your solar system, the fairest and most radiant of all the planets. That planet was the original home of Earthlings. In their native home they knew no pain, sorrow, suffering, sickness or death. But in the glory and wonder of their world they grew proud and arrogant. They made war among themselves and finally turned against the great giver of life. Ultimately they destroyed their own planet, which today exists only as a sterile and barren ring of asteroids and debris in the solar system. In order that those entities might gain understanding, compassion and brotherly love, they were born into the animalistic, material evolution of a lesser planet, Earth. Suffering, sorrow, frustration and death became their teacher. Their symbol became the man-beast. Each man must work out his own destiny and salvation. In the illusion of time and through repeated births and deaths, each entity slowly and painfully evolves spiritually toward its former glorified state of divinity. Eventually, all the entities of Earth will again attain their lost heritage. They will have learned understanding, compassion and true love for God and their fellows. I pondered his strange words thoughtfully, thinking as I did so that what he had said explained many apparent mysteries about man and his lot upon Earth. But soon my attention was distracted once more as I saw the figure of Neptune strangely waver again. Suddenly the question was in my mind, was he really there in the truest physical sense, or was he an immaterial projection into the physical world from another dimension? Did I see him in his true form and ordinary state of being, or merely a projected approximation of a man's appearance? These strange thoughts frightened me a little and carried me into two deep waters. A reassuring smile lighted his face. "Don't be alarmed, Orpheo. The answer to the troublesome question in your mind is both yes and no. On Earth, form, color, individuality and the material aspect of things is all important. In our world, these illusions are of practically no importance at all. Suffice to say that for you I am an approximation of myself as I really am. I can't make it any clearer in three-dimensional terms." I thought about my own troubled fellows of Earth. Impetuously, I asked, "What about Earth now? On the surface all seems fairly calm, but I know we are only drifting on dangerous and treacherous waters. In their hearts many people are troubled and afraid. There is the ever-constant fear of the H-bomb and of other horribly destructive weapons being developed in the laboratories. Also there is the creeping menace of communism that is threatening the world, and so many other things." When Neptune spoke his voice was calm and dispassionate. "Communism, Earth's present fundamental enemy, masks beneath its banner the spearhead of the united forces of evil. Along with good, all men have evil in their hearts to a degree. But some are much more evil than others. Communism is a necessary evil and now exists upon Earth as do venomous creatures, famines, blights, tyrannies, cataclysms. All are negative forces which awaken the positive forces of good in man and cause them to act. Thus are they combated, understood, and ultimately their unreality becomes apparent. For evil is always eventually self-destroyed." He paused and once more I noticed his uniform darkening and lightening in spots, as though it were made of restless pale bluish clouds and patches of moonlight. Then I held my breath as he continued, "Yes, war will come again to your Earth. We are powerless to prevent it. Millions in your land will fight to the end for their cherished ideals and freedom of the human mind, with only a minimum on their side for victory. The hour of travail, which in future history shall be known as the Great Accident, is nearer than any man dreams. And already the clouds of war are on the horizon, dark and ominous, but overhead beams the rainbow, infinite and eternal. Mankind will survive Armageddon and awake to a new, more glorious day of fellowship and honest brotherly love. In the dawning great new age of Earth, all will forget their bitter hurts and build constructively together upon the solid foundation of the brotherhood of man." He stopped speaking and turned his radiant eyes full upon me. In the half-light his countenance was truly resplendent. "There is not much more I can tell you now, Orpheo," he said. "Since the first publicized modern sighting of our disks in the year 1947, thousands upon Earth have come to believe in us. Many have actually seen our disks. Some have seen us clairvoyantly. Others have communicated with us clairaudiently. Still others recognize the truth of our existence and greater scope of our being, through intuitive perception. But as far as official proof of ourselves, for which so many clamor, we cannot offer that. Official proof of the existence of our disks will come. But for us to attempt physically to contact mankind through any so-called authoritative source would be only useless and possibly disastrous for them. Nearly all three-dimensional beings have no concept of, nor could they possibly understand, extra-dimensional beings. Tonight in visiting you I have broken a code, the code of hands-off, as regards any interference in the affairs of Earth. Active cosmic law will see the necessary amends made. He looked at me, his strange eyes suddenly saddened. For a moment I had the uncanny feeling that in his greater vision I appeared to him only as a fleeting, insubstantial shadow, utterly without reality as he knew it. In that revealing instant I knew that we of Earth are as far removed from their nature as Earth is from the sun. After a while he said, I would shake your hand in token of our momentous meeting here tonight. But I cannot. I have gone too far already. For my transgression we must now recede an equal degree from you. The immutable law of cause and effect upon Earth will govern accordingly. As a result, but few will believe or even hear your account of our meeting. In the overall picture your story will in no way change conditions upon Earth. Neither will any actual earthly event be either hastened or retarded because of our meeting. At most your story will give only greater faith and inner conviction to the few, but it is an important few. The ways of God are immutable and apparent only to those who have spiritual discernment. In the illusion of time all things will be fulfilled in their proper hour. I found that I was trembling and my nerves fairly quivering. Whether from sheer emotion or actually from being within the vibratory range of Neptune, I don't know. I longed to thank him, to express the great feeling of gratitude in my heart, but I didn't know quite how. I said, from the bottom of my heart I thank you, Neptune. I pledge my very life to you and the beings of your world, that greater understandings may come to mankind. We know you will not fail us, Orpheo, he replied. No other contact may be made at this time. But have no further doubts about the reality of your experiences. The road is open now, walk it as you will. Your failure will be my own. But I smile upon you for the increased numbers who will come to know us in a truer aspect and to believe in us because of you. Strength and encouragement will be given to the millions who will rise courageously to meet the fiery trials ahead. I tell you this, the great accident is very close and the fury of the next war will break when it is least expected, when men are talking of peace. I cannot say more. With these prophetic words, Neptune extended his hand to me. But recalling his words, I did not grasp it. He smiled and his face actually seemed to radiate light. Orpheo, my brother, he said with genuine affection. For my sake you refuse to break the code. My trust is forever in you, Orpheo. In your simple action you have cleansed me from my contact with this ground. He paused, then added, soon we shall recede from Earth, Orpheo, and yet in reality we shall never be far away. Later, we shall return, but not to you, beloved friend. You will understand the meanings of these words later on. When I made no reply, he said, I'm thirsty, Orpheo. Perhaps you know where we might get a drink of water? Oh yes, yes sir, I answered eagerly, getting quickly to my feet. I remembered a small nearby store that remained open all night. Please wait here, I'll be right back. I left him and clambered up the embankment. As I hurried toward the store, I turned and looked back at the Hyperion Bridge. Beneath the high center arch I made out the hazy outline of a kind of ghostly igloo which I immediately recognized as a saucer similar to the one in which I had ridden. At the store I bought 2 bottles of lemon soda and hastened back. But as I approached I was disappointed to see that the ghostly saucer was no longer beneath the arch of the bridge. Quickening my pace, I almost ran to the spot where I had left Neptune, but he was no longer there. I wasn't too surprised for I'd had a premonition he wouldn't be there when I returned. I tossed the sodas away and sank down upon the ground. The place was appallingly desolate without him. I felt so acutely alone, so helpless and deserted, like a child left alone in a dark room when the light is suddenly extinguished. I looked upward and my eyes hopefully searched the skies. High in the western heavens I saw a soft, fuzzy green light which hung for a moment, then shot away and vanished. Farewell, Neptune, I said softly as I felt my eyes grow moist. I know now Earth is not yet ready for a meeting with the beings from your world. But in the dawning of Earth's great new age, The day will come, friend, when we have learned the meaning of true brotherly love, when we have overcome to a greater degree the evil inherent in our selfish hearts, then perhaps we will be worthy to meet the infinitely wiser and gentler brothers of your world. In those days your fellows will visit us openly and joyfully. No longer will Earth be the accursed planet, home of sorrows. Chapter 4. We can appear and function as Earthmen, Ortheo. At first I told no one of my strange meeting with Neptune, for I knew only too well that my new story would meet with even greater disbelief and ridicule. But I immediately set to work writing down my further experiences. I had already placed my first experiences with the sources in manuscript form and planned to publish it as the first edition of a small personal newspaper, the 20th Century Times, but I had experienced difficulty in finding a publisher. Now I was glad the paper was not yet in print, for I could include my most recent experience with Neptune. I worked hard on the manuscript in my spare time. But the emotional and physical strain I was under began to tell on my health, and I felt the return of many of my old symptoms of extreme weakness and fatigue. In October of 1952 I applied for a leave of absence from my job at Lockheed. This was granted, and by an odd coincidence the first day of my leave started on the day the first strike in the history of Lockheed was called. I had the feeling that I had been saved from additional nervous stress and strain. Fortunately, the strike ended well and work resumed at the plant within a few weeks. With time off from work, I was soon able to complete the manuscript. Also, with the additional rest, my health rapidly improved so that I was strong enough to return to work within a month. The fellows at the plant knew of my interest in the sources, and many of them also knew of my first two experiences. I was in for a lot of ribbing from them. But on the whole it was good-natured, friendly ribbing, so I didn't mind. Several of those with whom I worked most closely frequently asked me for some kind of proof of the reality of my experiences. I told them of the shiny piece of strange metal I had picked up on the floor of the craft and explained how within a matter of minutes it disintegrated into nothingness. Also I told them of the burn I had received during my initiation in the saucer, which had resulted in a mark on the left side of my chest. Some of them looked at the mark in the form of the symbol of the hydrogen atom. But these things were not sufficient proof for them. One night at work several of them had been kidding me about my experiences. Al-Saradar quipped, "Just what kind of liquor you drinkin', Angie, that sends you out of this world?" Walter Cervaeke chimed in, "Yeah, tell us so we can take a ride in a saucer too." We had just rolled out a heavy dye. Al and I were removing the finished tray dome from it when suddenly there was a loud crackling sound as though a wooden plank had snapped.